Paddy.
Yeah. I was a bit confused about who was chairing. Nowadays, we just chair our own meetings, Piers, so...
Oh, OK.
You just shout out. We're all very polite.
OK, you've got your hand up, Paddy.
Well, I was only going to say, just this tender... Oh, but I couldn't remember writing that article. I wondered if you got me mixed up with somebody else, but I don't know. Maybe I did. Andy thinks I'm pissed already, but no, it's far too early for that. There is this tendency, isn't there, for people to constantly keep reinventing capitalism, you know, give it some shiny new term. It's always to create the illusion of change where there isn't any, you know. I know I've talked to people who've said things like, no, we used to be living under capitalism in 1950 or whenever it was, and now we're in a different system. Now we're in finance capitalism, like that's a completely different thing. Yeah. And then before that was industrial capitalism, and I don't know, it's just this sort of urge that people have to kind of rebrand the same system. I think it's just that it's a way of getting support, because people are always looking for the shiny new idea, aren't they? And so in the absence of any real revolutionary idea, this seems to be what people fall back on. I'm really surprised that if he calls himself a Marxist, even if he's an erratic one, you know, some of the things that Varoufakis says just seem very strange. I mean, you know, I think even a kind of introductory Marxist text would probably refute half of what he said there. But anyway, interesting talk, so thank you. That was all. I wasn't really going to ask a question, so that was it, really.
Me next.
Go on.
Thank you. Just echo what Paddy just said. Really interesting. But it occurred to me when you were talking about this, it seems to be based on having control over information, which is true, these people do, and they're putting forward information. And then I thought, hang on, well, isn't this a sort of thing that would occur or did occur, say, over 100 years ago with something like the Sears catalogue? It was a new form of putting goods in front of people's faces, you know, and this is, there's obviously a tight control over the information. It was published by one particular organization, and it got into so many people's homes in rural America. You know, it seems to me that kind of thing writ large and writ in binary code. Right. So just one question. I really didn't get what you said when you were talking about the different forms of value that are occurring. Was it experiential value or something that you said? And is that this idea of people, I'll just put up a photograph of what I had for my tea last night. Is that experiential value or something? Or could you expand on it?
I think it sounds like he's saying experiential value is use value, as we would understand it. But he's saying that isn't just commodities. Because you're providing the data, you are, when you post your picture of your dinner or whatever, you're adding value to the cloud capital.
What a load of bollocks. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Darren?
Just a quick point. I mean, first of all, I really enjoyed your talk, Piers. I think it's interesting how a lot of people seemingly have embraced the term techno-feudalism and embraced the idea of being living in techno-feudalism. And we can say, yeah, it's just another term for capitalism, you know, and it's not actually Factually true anyway, you know, the this new variation. But I just think it's interesting that people have embraced it, I think, because I think it signifies a sense of powerlessness that a lot of people now hold. You know, I actually think it's because people feel that things are so bleak and things are so beyond their control now that they hear this term and it sounds good. It's this kind of, you know, for want of a better expression, it's a sexy word, a descriptor of, you know, how we're at this moment. And these are people who are spending X amount of hours on their phones, X amount of hours like on social media, etc. And they're thinking, yeah, I'm not particularly happy about what's going on, you know, my existence. I'm just kind of like just existing rather. And that sounds out. Yeah, I'm powerless. There's a sense of powerlessness there, you know. And yeah, I can see that, you know. And I think that's what I take from it. You know, I don't pretend to. I've not read the book. I've not read many articles. But I think the idea that people are so ready to embrace this term to describe their own predicament tells its own story. Does that make any sense? I mean, even if you don't agree with me, but do you see where I'm coming from?
I absolutely see where you're coming from, yeah. I mean, I think that's it encapsulates it now, but I suppose when it's launched, we were just sort of just post-COVID. There are a lot of people perhaps feeling more like imprisoned then, perhaps. So that's why it's captured the imagination back then, and he decided to go for it with the book, perhaps. Okay, Adam next.
Oh, you're missing Andy out.
I think Adam had his hand up first.
No, Andy had his hand up first.
All right.
Ages ago.
If Adam doesn't mind, let's go for Andy.
I did have my hand up first, but I put it down.
Okay, Andy. You're muted, Andy.
Can't hear you.
Adam had his hand up first.
Oh, my mistake.
Well, you're on now, so let's...
Okay. I came in to the talks. Sorry about this, guys, but I came in just a little bit late. I think I missed the first 5 minutes or so. So, you know, excuse me if I've missed something important. But there's a few things about Varoufakis that is interesting. He's I just wrote a few little notes as I was listening through. And by the way, Piers, that was really interesting. And you're a great speaker, by the way. You've got a lovely sort of way of talking and engaging people. So I enjoyed the way you presented it. It was really, really good. But he's actually quite, like, he's a media figure, isn't he? You know, I mean, he's got the same hairstyle as me, for a start. He's not as good-looking or as handsome as myself, but, you know, I'll let that go. And he's got a sexy accent as well. And what tends to happen when he comes over the airwaves, I'm one of those people that I don't watch the telly or I have got a television. I'm not that curmudgeonly, but I don't watch it much. I listen to a lot of radio. And he's on the radio a lot. And so he'll come on to Radio 5 or Radio 4 or these commercial stations, you know, LBC and Times Radio and all those sort of things. And he's really kind of, when he comes on, it's like he's a bit of a rock star, you know. He's like a kind of a Glasgow Marxist, you know, or a celebrity kind of person, you know. What they never mention really is, like, basically he was really crap as the finance minister for Greece. The EU screwed them so hard up the jacksie, they went just completely bankrupt as a nation, you know. It was, but nobody ever mentions that. It's like he's fated as this sort of cool sort of guy, you know. So you know, basically, it's a lot of hot air, really. You know, you can read into what he's saying, and I agree with the previous speakers. Essentially, he's trying to rebrand what you know, we know as sort of like the way that capitalism works, but he doesn't do it very well. He doesn't really explain it properly. It's like some sort of introductory sort of foundational level text, you know, before somebody would do any sort of introduction to Marxism, you know. So I got no truck with his ideas at all, really. But I think we should be a bit more critical, to be really honest, rather than just take it as like, oh, it's kind of, it's worth even drilling into this sort of thing very much. So thanks, guys. Thank you very much indeed. And, well, yeah, sorry to use the word guys so often, though. It's pejorative, isn't it? Thank you.
I think you're right about the media personality. He's got that sort of a, when you see him interviewed, he's got that sort of a body language and turn of phrase that people that have had do TED Talks and sort of highly trained media people have. I think you're right about that. Yeah. Adam?
Yeah, I put my hand up originally to correct who wrote the book review, but somebody's already done that in the chat. But maybe people didn't see that.
Explains why Paddy didn't remember it. Yeah,
yeah, it was signed P.S. and P.S. doesn't stand for Paddy Shannon. It stands for Pick Smeet, who's of course, you know, Bill Martin. Anyway, that's all I was going to say. But to answer what Andy just said about. You know, when Yaroflakis was the Minister of Finance in Greece, that he failed. Well, he did fail, but I don't think it wasn't a personal failure. He couldn't have succeeded. If people remember the situation, they had this left-wing movement, Syriza, which was a reformist party, which, you know, won control of political power. They won an election, and what was his name now? Tsourakis or somebody, I don't know, became the Prime Minister, and Yaroflakis became the Minister of Finance. Well, he failed because they can't make capitalism work to do what the reformers wanted. So I think that's, that's the point, you know, to make about his failure as the Minister of Finance. I think you probably could argue that everything he's written since has been his revenge on that failure, on what the EU and the IMF and Germany imposed on him. Anyway, I mean, I think he's an interesting person. I mean, he's not a Marxist. He never was. Even before he was only a left wing, you know, Keynesian. But as I say, I think he has some interesting things to say, nevertheless.
Paddy,
Adam's put the record straight. Finally, I was a bit confused because I didn't remember writing book reviews. I'm too lazy to read an entire book. Sorry. I do occasionally, but yeah, to do reviews on. But I had been talking about. I remember talking about what I called high tech feudalism. I remember talking about that back in the 1990s because. Alvin Toffler did a book in 1993, Alvin and Heidi Toffler, called War and Anti-War. He was the guy who did the Third Wave and Future Shock and these sort of, you know, very futuristic things where very much Tory, no class analysis at all, but went around interviewing lots of sort of important people, business people, and stuff like that. And so he and Heidi Toffler were predicting what they called high-tech archipelagos. So it was the idea that on the trend of the 90s projected forwards, what was going to happen was that there was certain not countries, but regions of rich countries, but certain regions of small countries as well, that would rise above the kind of murk of poverty, the ocean of poverty, to become these high-tech archipelagos. So he mentioned California would be one. The rest of the United States would disappear into the sort of, you know, poverty swamp, but California would emerge. And I think he mentioned other places like Mumbai, in India, places in Jakarta, certain areas, regions, not necessarily cities, but just regions of the world that were just going to emerge, and that was what you were going to see. Quite interesting. That's not what happened, though, is it? Because what's actually happened is capitalism has sort of proceeded much more along conventional lines. But what we have seen, which does sort of a bit correspond to that, is these super rich individuals who've now, between them, got an almost monopoly on certain industries. And the, you know, if you think of the sort of billionaires who own their own space projects, these kind of people, these are the sorts of human archipelagos of the modern day. So the Toffler's argument back there was that these high-tech archipelagos were the start of a new age of high-tech feudalism, where all the normal laws of capital break down, and you get something like a return to serfdom. So, you know, with the hindsight of 30-odd years, it seems a bit overheated, their predictions. We're not in that world. But you can sort of see where they were going with that. And also from the point of view of people now, I think, looking at the current world, where the difference between the rich and the poor is, it's been increasing ever since the 1970s, and it's now, I don't know what the exact number is, but it's multiples of what of the level of inequality in the 1970s, and as a result, that is impressing itself on people's consciousness in a way that it didn't do 30 years ago, I think, and so I think the tendency to try to find new ways to describe this is probably quite attractive to people. You know, we just say, well, you know, this is just capitalism working, this is what capital does. But in people's sort of collective social memory, capitalism has never looked like this before. You know, it looks like we are in a completely different era. I mean, maybe people's collective social memory doesn't extend as far back as the 1900s and the so-called Gilded Age, when really you did have a whole system, at least in America, owned by half a dozen robber barons. I mean, that, if anything, like today, looks more like 1900 than it does like some sort of futuristic techno-feudalism. But we've also got, along with this sort of massive, massive inequality, just unprecedented level of inequality, we've also got round the world what looks like a full flight away from democratic systems, democratic ideals or ideas, into something like, you know, a trend towards despotism, even in the United States, at least for the moment. And we've even had a medieval plague recently. So, you know, I think there are parallels. People are drawing parallels. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm not defending it, but I do think I can see reasons why people do see that just calling capitalism doesn't really capture what's going on at the moment. I mean, it's quite an alarming time, I think. Anyway, we talked about this last week as well. But I think it does. I think things at the moment make people reach for these sort of millennialist terms, and I think especially with Generation Z, thinking it's the sort of, you know, I think they're all very depressed. They think it's the end of days kind of thing. So, yeah, sorry, I'm just rambling now. Just kidding.
They're very interesting. Very interesting. I suppose looking at it from the top down, the sort of mega rich of today do seem a bit like kings or barons, in terms of power. But workers of today, I don't think like serfs or peasants. Got a much broader world and very much in market relations for labour and for means of subsistence. I think it would work as a term to dredge up from a previous historical period. It works, perhaps works at the top, but perhaps not at the bottom. Just a thought. Mike.
Thanks. Thanks very much for a very interesting, engaging talk. I enjoyed that. Learned quite a lot as well, because I hadn't I'd heard of Varoufakis. I knew I was going to mispronounce his name. Varoufakis. Should be respectful. I didn't know too much about his work. I've sort of heard of him. It was interesting to sort of learn a bit about it. But I do wonder if, I know that book's only a couple of years old, and things could take a sharp turn in a different direction to the one he's sketched out if AI has much of an impact on the economy. As I say, I haven't read his book, so I don't know if he sort of takes this into account. But, regardless of AI's potential impact on, sort of cultural or information realms, there'd also be its impact on the economy, especially if it means that lots of jobs suddenly become redundant because they can be replaced by AI, and then it would have an impact on the labour market. So I don't know if whatever implications that has, to whatever extent, would mean that his theories are already a bit outdated, or has he taken that into account? And of course, there's also the possibility that AI won't have, a sort of seismic impact on the economy. I suppose it's still too early to tell. But I was just wondering if that was sort of accounted for, or if it's maybe not as big an issue as maybe I think it might be. Cheers. Thank you.
Well, in answer to that, Mike, yes, AI is accounted for in the book. I don't think he'd perhaps appreciated the rapid rise of it for creating images and videos and texts. But yes, it's definitely accounted for, particularly in this section on what he calls cloud proles, how AI is being used in production to make things a lot faster. Certainly, that gets a big mention, and perhaps because he hadn't seen that rapid rise in the large language models, when he talks about AI, it's more about extending and advancing existing algorithms and decision making, things like that, which is exactly what it is. Yeah, so it's definitely accounted for in his book. Yeah, JC.
Yes, this Varoufakis came to my attention, I think, back at the time there was much talk about a concept called Grexit, which in turn led to Brexit as a concept. Of course, Grexit never happened, and Brexit did, but that's just incidental. The thing about this Varoufakis chap is that he does say some things that are tantalisingly close to what we think, but I've never found them to be of any real substance, ultimately, and I think that's why I've only really made a superficial intrusion into what he's writing about, because... his idea of what seems to be the equivalent of use value is not really use value. It hints at being that, but then it veers away from it. So it's difficult to sometimes pin him down. Also, he seems to have, this is something I'm not sure about, as I say, I've only made a superficial intrusion into this subject of his writings. And although I have seen him, like Andy, I've seen him on TV and heard him on radio and whatnot, and he is quite a good talker. And I think that's one of the things that maybe a lot of people like about him, is the fact that he is critical of capitalism. But just being critical of capitalism, of course, is is not enough. We'll have to go further than that. But the thing I wondered about, and I don't really know about this because I don't know the detail, but he said something about, or he accords equivalence to Maynard Keynes' notions about money, and he accords a certain equivalence to it that is, it's like it's on the same level as Einstein's general theory of relativity. And I think that's just absolute balderdash, absolute pish, you know, just nonsense. But I just wondered if you could perhaps say something about that, because I'm not too sure about how he justifies this. Thanks.
I haven't. It doesn't. I don't think he mentions Keynes in passing in this book. I don't think he goes into any depth on it. And the bit I talked about where he's suggesting that profit doesn't matter anymore because these big tech companies are accumulating capital via central bank money printing and all this, and it's not very well explained. It's just glossed over in a couple of sentences in the appendix that I've been talking about, and it refers it into the main body of the book, and then even there it's just a couple of paragraphs, and it's not really very convincing, I don't think. So I think I agree. I mean, definitely, obviously, his sort of Marxist understanding is very light. And yeah, some of the his economic explanations of what's going on now, not convincing, really. The cynical part of me says that he just made up, got this techno-feudalism because he thought it would sell some books. I don't know. Adam.
Yeah, before he became the finance minister of Greece, and under that left-wing, you know, Syriza government, he was justifying the policy he was doing, which was to save capitalism from itself. And he did, you know, quote Keynes at that time. I mean, of course, a lot has happened since then. But I think he's not the first person either to say that capitalism, you know, doesn't exist or has ceased to exist. I think there was, you know, what's his name, J.K. Galbraith in the 1960s or 70s, I think, wrote a book called The New Industrial State, which argued that capitalism was no longer capitalism, but it was taken by corporations, and their object wasn't to make profits, much profit, but was to grow larger and larger, and could pay the managers bigger bonuses and so on. So his argument was capitalism had ceased to exist and had become something else, and other people said, I mean, there's the Labour Party thinker, Tony Crossland, he also wrote a book called The Future of Socialism, which he said, look, capitalism no longer exists. You know, that's, profit is no longer the main aim. And you can go even further back to that, of course, to theories of the managerial revolution. And the Deleonite Socialist Labour Party of America, they used to call Russia under Stalin, industrial feudalism, and other people called it, bureaucratic collectivism. All these other attempts to, to say that the capitalism will cease to exist. Mind you, having said that, I think it would probably make more has more validity to call what happened in Russia as industrial feudalism than these modern theories, because the workers had no rights at all. And they were just allocated a sum of money to spend, but they also had lots of things, supplied for them free. So this, concept, he's not saying anything particularly new in terms of terminology, but of course this these things never existed before, did they? You know, computers and clouds and all that type of technology. So he is making, if you like, updating these other theories, which said that capitalism no longer exists because, you know, profit is no longer the main aim. But I think, as we said, it still is.
Howard?
You're missing Andy again, Piers. He was had his hand up well before me.
How did they? Sorry, I wasn't paying attention on the order. Right. Just go on there, Andy.
Go on, Andy. Go on, it's you.
Thank you, Howard. Thanks, Piers. And I'm glad Adam said the point, made the point that he just made, actually, because that is. Well, I think also, I'm not exactly sure who it was that was also saying, you know, that ultimately there's a market for these sorts of books. And they fit into really like what mainstream sort of literary, well, I wouldn't call it literary, but mainstream kind of critical, readable, sort of liberal texts sort of look like, really, you know. I mean, they go back a long way, and Adam actually mentioned Anthony Crossland, you know, for example. Well, he was no revolutionary, you know, he was, you know, he was a senior figure in the Labour Party in my lifetime. I remember him. There's another guy that was in the media as well that wrote. I've got the book. I haven't actually got round to reading it. I think there must have been a review in the Standard. The bloke that used to do reports on Newsnight with a northern accent. Can't quite remember who he was. He's sort of like a working class version of Robert Peston. He wrote a book with post-capitalism in the title, I think. So, you know, there's a sort of a whole genre, really, of this sort of stuff that never really goes anywhere. It just goes round in circles, and they get published, and they get publishers, and they do talks. But actually, it's very acceptable to the mainstream media. The ruling class aren't scared of it, and it's all just sort of, you know, it's a bit like, you know, pop music for people that like to think they're a bit radical, you know. So that's how I would see it, really.
Thanks. Howard?
Adam and Andy have sort of covered the same kind of thing that I was wanting to say, in a way, that, you know, people are always looking for twists on things, aren't they? It's not straightforward capitalism. It's a different form of capitalism, or not capitalism at all. I mean, I remember a long time ago when I was sort of first in the party, there was this theory of permanent arms capitalism. Mike Kidron, wasn't it, who wrote the book called The Permanent Arms Economy? More recently, there's been disaster capitalism, which is different from, we all know it's different from the sort of common garden capitalism. And as I say, people are always sort of looking for these twists. And I remember a number of years ago, probably 7 or 8 years ago now, I wrote a review for The Standard on a book called A Radical History of the World, a great tome of a thing, a brilliant book, by the way, written by Neil Faulkner. And it was a fantastic book, but he's a trot. And when he sort of covered more recent times, that came out very clearly. He made no secret of it. And there was this sort of quite significant section on what's happened in recent years to capitalism. It's become, and this has already been mentioned, it's become finance capitalism. And I couldn't really, I was sort of way behind in this kind of thing. I didn't really know what it was on about. I remember speaking to Adam about this and saying, look, he's going on about finance capitalism, you know, what exactly is it? And, you know, what's to be said? And Adam more or less said, forget it. And I did. I didn't actually include it in the review at all. And, you know, I'm not bothered that I didn't, because although it's still being talked about now, you know, basically it's it's a bit of a chimera, really. So, I mean, we shouldn't be sort of too concerned that people are somehow, on frequent occasions telling us that, look, the system isn't as it was. This is different. That's different. And therefore, we've got to look at it differently. Not the case at all. Not the case at all. There'd have to be something far more fundamental than the kind of thing Varoufakis is talking about for us to sort of abandon what is the fundamental sort of Marxist analysis of capitalism.
Thanks. Yeah. Thank you. John?
Yes. Further to this idea of, the people who tell us that capitalism's actually not capitalism, you also get people who, in fact, I think I've heard more of them from the point of view that capitalism is actually a good thing and what we're experiencing now is a bad thing, so therefore it can't be capitalism. I remember one such person on GB News, I think it was, in fairly recent times, and on that occasion, Paddy was there to correct his foolishness because this guy was saying that capitalism was something that happened during Victorian and Edwardian times, and everybody had a great time. It was just great for everybody. Where he got his information from definitely wasn't the Socialist Standard, and it probably wasn't even from the pro-capitalist media, because even they had to admit there were some social problems. But there's always people trying to put a new twist on these things, because I suppose many of them are looking at it in a much more superficial way. So they see these things that stand out and sort of seize upon them, and they misuse the terms like hypotheses and theories. Like I noticed Varoufakis in one sentence described what he was saying as a theory, and then in the next he referred to it as a hypothesis. So there's clearly even confusion and a very, very simple simple logical, categorical understanding of things. I thought it's just worth mentioning that, there are all these people on what they maybe call the right wing, certainly pro-capitalist rather than anti-capitalist, who deny that it's capitalism because it's not functioning like the good old days when capitalism worked for everyone, which it never ever did, as we know. Of course, there's no, it's no question about that. Thanks.
Yeah, well, thank you. I suppose I just thought back to my when I gave a talk here before, and I pointed out an article from a very early Socialist Standard where it said that the rapid development of the forces of production in capitalism were causing it to constantly change form and look differently to people because of the it was a rapidly innovating system. Yeah, Steve.
Yeah, I was going to say actually something a little bit similar to that. This claim that that capitalism doesn't work as it used to do, or it doesn't exist anymore. Earlier on, Darren was talking about people's feeling of powerlessness in the face of the economics or the politics or whatever. I wonder whether a lot of it is to do with the fact that much of production has decamped away from Europe, away from Britain, away from America, and it's gone to what used to be called the Third World. And so the people in this country, for example, when we if people are looking for wage rises, they're not in direct confrontation with capital. They're not in direct. They're in direct confrontation in fact with the government, or with financiers, the people who've received income, rather than in a relationship with direct with productive capital directly. And And this, in a way, this takes away some of the power that trade unions had. Because if you were working in a factory or a shipyard or a coal mine, you should have been able to see when the orders were going out, that the company was doing okay, and so on and so forth. And we now don't have that sort of economic position anymore. Of a direct relationship with productive capital. I'm talking in general terms, of course. So I wonder whether that's partly to do with, you know, the way that people are getting confused and going, oh, yes, it's all now finance. But what we've got to reiterate is that the finance is just the scum on the top of the system. That's all it ever will be. And the real value is created in the productive process, making commodities, not to the same extent in the distribution or in the provision of, you know, social services, education, and things like that. Right. Just one other quick point about. I often say, well, it's not much different from in the past when we're talking about AI. What we've got to remember is just the sort of thing that that Piers mentioned from the early socialist standard. the reason what the effect of AI will be to de-skill the majority of the people that are using that type of technology. It will reduce wages for them and so on. It's going to be we've already seen it in the industry that I worked in for the last 20 odd years, and it's been seen in now. We've seen it in screenwriters. We've seen it in even models. What do you call it? Fashion models are seeing this as a problem for their own earnings. And this is one of the major contradictions that will always face workers under capitalism. Right, thank you. I've rambled on.
What are you talking about? They're talking about replacing models with holograms or something.
They're able to do it. Yeah. It was about 2 months ago, I thought, something like that. I saw it in I think probably the BBC.
Yeah. Certainly, in my job, they've advertising copywriting. They're using AI heavily, and they're moving to videos now to create crappy advertising dross. So.
Yeah, and this is actually putting technicians out to work as well, because what they're doing is they're obviously scraping the internet and using images that have already been created to create new content. So yeah, so you are getting technicians from the advertising industry. For filmmaking industry, getting them knocked out to work at the same time as models are being thrown. In actual fact, the other day there was something on the Beeb about they've created an AI cover for one of some fashion magazine. I've forgotten the details. That's just really weird, right?
And I was telling you the other day how in my industry the low level jobs which AI can do low level coding, not low level coding, you know, basic sort of generic, more generic stuff, and those jobs are, you know, those jobs are disappearing. The high level jobs are still there, but AI, when we imagine, will, when it becomes able to think of software architecture, it's probably gonna start affecting those jobs as well. Yeah, Andy.
Yeah, thank you. And actually, what Steve just talked about, in one respect, chimes a little bit with what I was going to say. I mean. I think my point would be more slightly broader, But I'm thinking about perhaps over the past sort of 40 years, and also sort of there's some personal experience here really as well, where when I, kind of call it like an education. It was a decent education actually when I went to university, and in those days, this is going back a long time now, but we talked about the atomization of society, and things like the miners' strike were very fresh in the memory, for example, other industrial disputes that Steve alluded to. You know, these things were quite live sort of events, really, you know, maybe not happening right at that time, but certainly very fresh in the public imagination. And, sorry about that. What I think has sort of happened since then, that this chimes into this pattern of these sort of very unthreatening ideas, you know, that come in to tell us that capitalism has changed, is also maybe, just maybe, a consequence of the fact that actually the working class as a threat has actually disappeared. No one's sort of like the ruling class, the media people. I keep thinking about the media when I say that. I mean these billionaires that like control the thought processes of everybody and run the what were newspapers, but now like commercial radio stations and television stations and things like that. Are pumping out this idea that I think, Comrade Cumming alluded to as well earlier, which was that, you know, oh, capitalism is good for us. There's never been anything better, you know, and this is as good as it is, you know. And so people who come along like Varoufakis, who actually can't change a dicky bird, really, suddenly have some relevance. It's just how I kind of look at those things. Thanks.
Thanks, Andy. Paddy?
I think Howard might have got there just before me.
Oh, the...
It's okay, Paddy, you go on, so no problem.
I was just going to follow up just by something Andy just said about, you know, people like Varoufakis can write these books and it doesn't really make any difference. And I was thinking, yeah, that I think that's right. And I was struck. I mentioned this last week, how South Park have launched, they've just done their second episode of the new series, and they're going really hard at Trump, at Vance, at Tulsi Gabbard, Pam Bondi, all these people, really, really going hard at them. And they're using, one of the things they're doing is using AI deep fakes. They look so realistic. I don't know. I mean, I keep, for some reason on my YouTube feed, I keep getting sort of videos of gorillas beating up crocodiles and things like this. It looks hyper realistic. And I'm thinking, hang on a minute. I thought gorillas lived in the sort of, the high rainforest of Uganda and the Congo, and they don't live anywhere near crocodiles. Well, apparently they do occasionally share the same habitat, but it's extremely unlikely you'd ever get a footage, live footage of a gorilla beating up a crocodile. And there's other ones of tigers beating up crocodiles or crocodiles beating up elephants or something like that, and they look hyper realistic, and you can't really tell from looking at them, you know. There's nothing obviously fake about them, but they must be fakes, and there's loads of them, and YouTube is just full of this stuff at the moment. Anyway, that's a bit of a by-the-by. That's a sort of another development of AI that is taking us over. It's like a tsunami. So we're getting to the point where we're just not going to know what's true. We're going to have to fall back on our sort of, you know, Occam's razor and our critical abilities. But, I mean, sadly, it seems to me a lot of people don't have any critical abilities. They just do believe what they see. But anyway, the South Park thing, they are going very hard after the Trump regime using AI because they actually, these two guys who write it, they're so rich, they just bought their own AI deepfake company just to do this, just for this one thing. So the power that these two guys have got in a sort of stupid cartoon to do damage to the Trump regime, I think far outweighs the thing, any sort of effect that people like Varoufakis have got. Whether that's a good thing or not, I wouldn't care to say, but yeah, certainly those two guys, Parker and Stone, are using AI to really land some heavy punches, and the White House is furious by all accounts. They've complained about it to Paramount and all this sort of thing, but Paramount don't care. They're seeing their ratings absolutely skyrocket as a result of this. So, anyway, that's just what's been going on the last couple of days.
Oh, that's interesting. Thanks. I don't know if you saw that story this week about Wikipedia brought out a guide for how to tell if text is AI generated. And there's the bit about the EM dashes, also about it's basically always sounds like advertising copy. Probably, if you imagine that all these language models have been trained on the sort of raw internet, a great deal of the internet is advertising copy. So it kind of makes sense. But a lot of the AI, you can identify the AI text by it being unnecessarily upbeat and
could I just come back on that very quickly, sorry, yeah, to impose on Howard a second. The other thing I meant to say was I just did some editing work for this guy who's written, well, I say written in air quotes, two short sort of health and fitness guides, and he did it entirely through I think Gemini, it was one of these things, and it is exactly as you say. Every line of it was a really sort of super upbeat. Hey guys, now what we're going to do? This is what we're going to do. Let's keep it real. And it's just tedious beyond belief. And it's all just cliche after cliche after cliche after cliche. And so I think people are going to tire of that really quickly, unless the AIs get really good. I mean, if they start doing bloody I don't know, Dickens or. or Proust, or you know, if it starts being really good, maybe it'll be different. But at the moment, it's just dreadful. And most of these agencies that use copywriting, they pay absolute peanuts anyway, so they get shit copy. And I don't know why they bother, because I can't believe anyone's really persuaded by any of this. So yeah, I don't think that's really going to work. Anyway, sorry, that was just a by the by.
Thanks, Howard.
I was going to say that what I've got to say is a bit off the subject, but we've strayed into AI anyway, so it's a sort of part of what's been talked about the last few minutes. I was going to say that I'm a bit of a technophobe, but I'm absolutely gobsmacked by what AI does. I'm sort of, I don't work in a university, but I'm closely attached to a university. And I sort of still do work for the union I'm a member of there. So I have quite close contact with staff in universities, and they're tearing their hair out because students are presenting projects and essays and dissertations, which are absolutely first rate. They can't prove the students haven't written them. They know they haven't really. But they're so good that they just don't know what to do. Very, very difficult to accuse them of using AI. You can just say they haven't. How would you prove it? Etc. And it's amazing what it does. And I'll just give you an example of something that happened to me this week. I was assisting a member of staff who is threatened with losing his job because he hasn't passed his probation, they say, etc. You know, his work isn't satisfactory, teaching, he makes mistakes, etc., etc. And he's got a meeting coming up at which this will be discussed and finalised. And I said to him, look, what you must do before the meeting is put your case on paper, because if it's just discussed in the meeting, it all vanishes into the ether afterwards and they can do what they want. If you put it in black and white, much more difficult for them to do that. He said, right, I'll do that. I said, do that and we'll get it to them before the meeting. Now, this member of staff, he's foreign, he's African, and his English is simply not very good. He's written me a couple of emails recently, and honestly, you know, you struggle to understand some of it. He said, don't worry, I'll do it. And he's done it, and it's absolutely first class. There's no way he's written that. I know he hasn't. He's made an excellent case for himself, you know, all power to him, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, they're going to struggle to say, no, you know, we've got it right. We, you know, you know, and your case isn't a good one. He has made a very good case indeed. It's really turning so many things upside down. There's just one example amongst sort of, you know, lots of others that are emerging in these sort of places of learning where, you know, people are using AI as a shortcut.
Oh, that's very interesting. Are they still using that software to detect plagiarism? I know some places they'd run students' essays through.
There's no point anymore.
So it just doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work anymore. No, I mean, I think most students are using that thing called, is it ChatGPT? You know about that?
Yeah.
I think that's what they're using mainly. Maybe using others as well. I don't know.
Well, interesting. Right. Any further contributions? Okay, is this the point where we ask what's happening next week?
Okay, I can. Next week, Anto is going to speak on. I went to Marxism 2025 and couldn't find Carl. He went to some talks on Russia at the SWP's annual event. So that's what's on next week.
Adam, can I say, was that the occasion when the socialist workers got attacked by these right wing groups?
He was there on the Friday, and they attacked on the Saturday. But he's seen the video that they put up about about it, so he can mention that, I think, as well. Yeah.
Okay.
It was the leader of UKIP who was walking around with an umbrella instructing these people what to do, but it was all these blokes against all these women. It was anyway. Maybe he'll tell you more about it.
Oh, and I've got another hand up there.
Hi, Piers. Sorry. My name's Gumran. Just introduce myself very quickly. I'm from the Platypus Affiliated Society, but I'm not here for that. I wanted to ask about the spectre of feudalism, right? Why does that seem to keep haunting the history of capitalism? I think some people have kind of raised it today, right? I think someone mentioned like high-tech feudalism or like the kind of Trotskyist period where people talk about bureaucratic collectivism. So this summer we read like these pre-Marxian socialists, right, up from like Babouf, Fourier, the Chartist, and kind of culminated in Victor Considerant. So Victor Considerant is like this very important figure in the French 1848 revolution. And he writes a manifesto, The Principles of Socialism, Manifesto of Democracy, right? And if I may, I just want to read very quickly, right, from a little short passage, because it brings up that feudalism question again. And it's interesting to me that as the workers are demanding that the right to work is put on par to the right to property, in their imagination, they're also understanding this thing as feudalism, right? That this decay of bourgeois society is feudalism. So I just want to read the short passage from Considerant. So he says, absolute liberty without organization is then nothing but the absolute abandonment of the disarmed and deprived masses to the mercy of the armed and equipped forces. Civilization, which began with the feudalism of nobles, gradually freed the industrious from personal or direct servitude. Today it has evolved into industrial feudalism, which imposes on workers collective or indirect servitude. So this is on the eve of the 1848 revolution, right? It's on the eve of before Marx even writes the Communist Manifesto. So this spectre of feudalism seems to keep raising its head all the time. So just wondering, like, I mean, why do you think that is? Why do you think, like, on the eve of the workers even entering the historical stage, right, to possibly transform the mode of production, that it's recognized as feudalism? I think that's quite peculiar. And what does that say about our current moment? Right, they're demanding the right to work. Right. So I'm just curious about what you think about that.
Thanks. I mean, personally, I think the vast majority of workers have no sort of real concept of what feudalism is. I think it's probably all to do with the feeling of we were less free in the past and we should be more free in the future. You know, you mentioned servitude there, and I think what they know about feudalism is that it was a time when most people were serfs and peasants. So when you say spectre of feudalism, I mean, it's just that aspect of it, really. I don't think most workers really have an idea of what it was like to be a peasant and bound.
I think they had a better understanding of capitalism than we do. The people in 1848 had a better understanding of capitalism than we do. So I don't think it's fair to say that they didn't understand capitalism. I think they have a better understanding than us, right? They took up Marxism eventually. We seem to be struggling, agonizing whether, you know, not us, but like society, whether this is feudalism, whether this is post-capitalism, whether it's neoliberalism, what is this thing, right? But they are kind of like, oh, this thing is decadent or something, right?
Yeah. Well, I think workers today don't, you know, they feel like increasingly there's less choices, and that's associated with being in feudalism. It's not an accurate conception of feudalism, I don't think.
By the way, I didn't say that in the chat. I don't know why that says that. I didn't say that.
Do you want to come back on that? We've got someone else waiting to make a contribution. Andy?
Yes, thank you, comrades. And comrade Cumran, is that right? Is that the right way to... Yep, thank you. Thanks for your intervention. Actually, I just so happened yesterday to return from the...
Andy, that's not me in the chat. I don't know who's doing that. Like, I'm not typing that, I promise you. There's somebody, like, pretending to be me in the chat. That's not me, I promise you. You can see the second name is not spelt my way. I don't know why somebody would do that.
Oh.
I promise you that's not me.
Right. Okay, I was just going to talk about Arkwright's Mill, that's all.
Let's hear about Arkwright's Mill.
Well, all I was going to say was I was in Derbyshire yesterday and... passing through the small town, it's not really a town, but it's a small settlement called Cromford. And there's a place there, a workspace, which apparently, allegedly, was the first factory that was ever established in within capitalism. And so... I just thought every time I go through that road and drive past or even go down and have a look at it, I look at Arkwright's Mill and I think, well, that's where capitalism started. And then what I do is I get on my bike and I go up and I go through the Peak District of Derbyshire and I look at all these little villages and I think, oh, somebody owned this land, somebody had cottages and somebody... Essentially, before capitalism, it was sort of the overwhelming social system. People relied on a landlord, a feudal landlord, and so I find it hard to equate feudalism and capitalism as something that's the same. There was a revolutionary time when there was just a change in the way that society was organised. It didn't change the way of life for the vast majority of people who essentially had to make a living or scrape a living from the resources, the meagre resources that were at their disposal. So I'm a bit sort of troubled by some of the messages that have been coming up, so I'm going to stop. Okay, thanks.
You've been hacked by someone. Someone in the chat is messaging people. You can see my hands. It was not me typing.
Yeah, I'm deleting these messages. It looks like somebody's hacked.
I'm sure the moderator.
Yeah.
Can the moderator remove that person?
Yeah. I can't see that person. I don't know who it's coming from. It's just
Adam.
Hello, sorry. I can't see who this is. He's posting it. He just keeps posting it under different aliases.
It's Dr. Fergus M now.
Yeah.
Can you chuck them out?
Well, I don't know who they are.
It's saying James now.
Yeah. Right.
Now it's gone to Adam.
It's quite sad that someone's going to use all that ingenuity just to fuck up a meeting. That's just quite pathetic. Quite a sad person that would do that sort of thing. But I've now forgotten what I was going to say, so I'll try and recover myself. Thanks.
Should we have Adam first?
You're muted, Adam.
Perhaps that's not the real Adam.
Oh, God.
And I just got right. I put my hand up. I was going to ask the speaker from Platypus, is it possible that he could put the name of the French utopian, socialist that he quoted from in the chat? Because I didn't catch that, and I have to be honest, I'm not up on my utopian socialists. I only know the usual suspects. Because I was interested in what he said, but I just was, just didn't catch the name. Cheers.
Yeah, it was Victor Considerant. He was a Fourierist. So Fourier was the real kind of utopian. He's the one who's talking about perhaps socialism, you'll be able to drink lemonade out of the oceans, right? He's like a very interesting utopian socialist. Victor Considerant is a bit more like serious. He was a member of the Constituent Assembly, the 1848 revolution. So he's a bit more like, he doesn't have a concept of like surplus value, but he's still interesting to look at in terms of like a pre-Marxian socialist. And Dory Darren, I know that's not you. Somebody's being a knobhead in the chat.
So I can ask what happened to him? I mean, what sort of age was he in 48? And, where was he like in 1870 if he was anywhere?
Participated in the Paris Commune as well. Marx makes fun of him later on, like in the, I think it's like in the 1848 period, just as Marx is becoming Marx. He kind of makes fun of Considerant because Considerant makes kind of a fetish for democracy. But yeah, he does participate. I think he moves to Texas. Like there's like a utopian, what's it called again? The Icarian community or something. They're trying to set up this utopian community in Texas. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, cheers. No, I'll look him up. Cheers. Thank you.
Adam, are you there?
Yeah, but I must have raised my hand by mistake.
Oh, okay, no problem. John?
Yes, all I was going to refer to was this thing that a lot of workers have. In fact, I think it's the so-called education system probably encourages it, that most people don't see the distinction between wage slaves and serfs. So when they hear people talking about peasants, they can identify with that. They can say, oh, yes, to these rich bastards, we're all peasants. But they use it in a very, not in the specific way in which we would use it. So that's just one of these unfortunate things. Even the term dumbing down is itself a dumbed down version of the language. From personal experience, I've encountered people in the workplace, for example, in my office. I've heard people talking about themselves as, oh, yeah, we're just peasants. But some of them have been genuinely shocked when I've referred to us as wage slaves. On the other hand, I've heard others wandering off to another part of the office, and when someone says, why are you here? They say, well, can one wage slave not come and visit another? So sometimes what you say can have a small effect, but, you know, it's nomenclature isn't a strong point. It's not something that's encouraged amongst the workers or amongst anyone. Because in capitalism, what it's all about, as we know, is just saying what needs to be said to perpetuate the system. And all these BBC guys better understand that they're not paid these massive bloated salaries because of their own special talents. It's just because they have a knack of knowing how to say the right thing. And as soon as they stop saying the right thing, they'll soon find out that job won't last much longer, because the BBC will not tolerate that degree of anti-capitalism. But I've kind of digressed away from what I was going to originally say, so I'll just leave it at that just now. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, John. Any further contributions? Okay, 9:15, call it a night there.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Piers. Cheers.
My pleasure, guys.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Piers.